Hi, everybody. This is Alan from If This Goes On, Don't Panic.
And Paul Jessup from Fear is the Fire That Lights the Heart.
And today we decided to have a crossover podcast where we discuss solar punk and horror and kind of contrast and compare the two genres slash subgenres, I guess. I'll give the audience here the TLDR version. Ages ago, Susan K. Quinn, who is one of our guests, and I, we talk about solar punk, and at some point she said, solar punk and horror are two sides of the same coin. So fast forward a few years, Paul and I were chatting about doing some stuff together, and this topic came up. And so Susan is here to talk about solar punk, and then we have Maurice Brodus here to talk about horror. So welcome, Suzanne and Maurice.
Hey, hello. Glad to be here.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, awesome. Hey, I didn't think of this till now for some reason, but you all should probably give a short bio for yourselves. Maurice, do you want to go first and then Susan?
Sure. So I often describe myself as having three jobs. So I'm a science fiction, fantasy, and horror writer of about 20 books and over 100 short stories. I'm a librarian at a middle school. We recently restored a historically black library, so I'm now the head librarian there. And then I'm also the resident Afrofuturist at a local community organization. So that's me in a nutshell.
Very nice. I'm like super excited to be in conversation with Maurice. I have been going to the library so much lately. I'm a huge, huge fan. And I talk a lot about how libraries prefigure a solar punk future. So maybe we can talk about that. But so I'm a full-time author. I've been writing for about 14, 15 years now, publishing, making business out of it, and write across genres, steampunk, solar punk now, but mostly was science fiction in the beginning. And I also have a secret spicy romance pen name, which is very fun. But my past life, I have a PhD in environmental engineering. Have been very eco-focused. Work for NASA, research global warming, designed aircraft engines, like super nerd, and then stayed home with my kids and then decided, you know what? Maybe I'll do that creative thing and started writing, and that was just fully addicting, and I've been doing that ever since.
Oh,
And if you
nice.
ever need anyone to talk to you about wind resistance in your car, Susan can do it because she has talked to me about that exact topic before.
It's true.
Susan, I wouldn't mind starting with you and just saying, like, when you mentioned to me that they're two sides of the same coin, what did you mean by that?
I think what I was trying to get at was that they're both reactions to our time. They're for some people, the horrors persist in real life, so they want something that has a future vision that is of a better future that actually seriously grapples with things like the climate crisis, the justice issues we have in our world. How do we survive? Horror. Now, I am not a horror reader or writer, so I have to speak secondhand, which is again why I'm super glad to be here in conversation with Maurice and hear like more about is does this track at all? But my idea from talking to my friends was that horror works at a couple of different levels as a reaction. One is it's just very engaging, like you are just drawn in and for a moment, you forget about the rest, right? So all fiction can work it that way, but horror has like a lot of power in that. And another way, I feel like it helps us to have some kind of agency, right? Like sometimes the horror resolves and goes away, unlike the horror in the real world. And so there's a lot of different ways that it's helping us to deal. And some people, we just have different people, right? Like not everybody's the same. And so our cope is going to be different. And I just saw this working, like both of them sort of rising in popularity at the same time. And I'm like, hey, that seems connected. Like it's doing something for people on different levels, and they're different people. They're not usually the same people. So I just found that fascinating. and I'm looking forward to exploring it.
Paul, you know, you're a horror writer. Maurice, you've mm-hmm. kind of written both. Like, thoughts, reactions?
Well, yeah, I can, let's see. I'm trying to think. So my first half of my career, I literally came up as a horror writer. So like the first 10 years of my career, strictly as a horror writer, mostly writing horror short fiction, things like that. And before I shifted into, I think I did the same sort of transition, you know, going into urban fantasy, then steampunk, and then science fiction, then bouncing back and forth between all of the genres. I distinctly remember talking to my therapist at one point, and one of the interesting conclusions I came to was that when I'm writing horror, I'm actually writing from a place of anger. And so it's, and again, just speaking to Susan's point about reactions, it's my anger. My anger is a response to basically the situation and the circumstances we find ourselves in. And so that's not just present day systems, for example, but it's also historical. And so the historical systems of oppression, for example, that my people have been under. So then I'm like, so I'm still having anger reactions to that. But then when I'm writing science fiction, I'm actually writing from a different place. I'm actually writing from a place of dreaming. So I'm dreaming about possibilities. I'm dreaming about better potential futures. I'm dreaming about where we could find ourselves. And so I end up, you know, so that whole idea of two halves, because, you know, it's not like I quit writing horror by any stretch, since I have like, I think, four coming out this year, because oddly enough, circumstances have found me in an angry place again. But I also firmly believe that that's partly where these systems want us, is for me for us to stay in that place of anger and frustration. And so I'm like, oh, no, I will give myself room to be angry, but I won't let you keep me just in my angry space. You don't get to rob me of being able to dream about possibilities and futures and where we could find ourselves. So, again, I just continue writing in both lanes.
I love that. I love hearing that. That you're holding space for both of those. And I think it's really hard for people to figure out how to hold space for both of those, you know, like get kind of drowned in one or like forget to allow the other. And that's really amazing. I love it.
I think it's interesting too, because you can look at it as being part of the present and the future then. Because like the present, the horror, the anger is like a call to action, and the future, like the, you know, Afrofuturism and solar punk is about like creating a response to the anger of the present by creating a better future. So the two seem to go hand in hand.
Right. And one of the important things about Afrofuturism is also that while it is a critique of the present, that critique is always rooted in history. It's rooted in the past. And so you do have the sense of past, present, future always working together.
Yeah, one thing I find a lot with solar punk, mostly with people that don't actually read it and definitely don't read my stuff, is like they think that you're not angry. They think that you just are kind of warm and fuzzy and thinking about utopia and all these soft, nice things. And sure, like, yes, I'm, because that's like the world that I would like to have. But also, it's deeply rooted in being angry and not willing to look away from the past and the present, because we got a lot going on that is broken. And so you can't really reasonably, justifiably imagine a better future if you don't know what's wrong with now. So
that's funny, because I usually get the opposite reaction. People are always expecting me to be this fiery, angry individual whenever they meet me, and I'm just like, no, I'm chill. We're good. I've gotten it all out on the page, so I'm like, I'm fine.
Yeah, that's like most horror writers I know. You know, they expect somebody to be like, you know, just, you know, a terrible, horrible human being, angry all the time, or like violent, and they're not. They're just calm. Right. They're cool. They're the nicest people you'll ever meet.
Maurice, you've got to be one of the chillest guys I've ever met.
I appreciate that.
By the way, this is kind of a tangent a little bit, but I picked up the Black Fantastic last weekend, and you are in it, sir.
Yes, I am.
So I'm looking forward to reading this.
In fact, I believe that short story ties into my my Astra Black trilogy, my Afrofuturist, my current trilogy I'm working on.
Nice.
Yeah, was that Sweep of Stars? Is that right?
Yep. Sweep of Stars was book one. Breath of Oblivion is book two. And then they just announced book three coming out next March, A City Dreaming.
Awesome. Awesome. I kind of want to explore the anger thing a little bit, because it's funny, Maurice, that you mentioned that horror is anger for you. I mean, I would agree with that. And I think solarpunk for me is more about like anxiety than horror or anger. You know what I mean? Like, I'm angry, yeah, but it's more about like, oh my gosh, what can we possibly do to solve this problem? You know what I mean? Right. Oh good, there's people thinking about it, and I wanna read about that stuff.
I think some of the solar punk embodies anger in the punk part, right? So you've got like a whole lot of people who are, you know, fuck the patriarchy, tear down capitalism, you know, like in their story. Or at least maybe that's just me. I don't know. But like a lot of solar punk is very leaning into radical stuff, at least compared to what we have now in the status quo. And so... So you can have angry characters, for sure. And that ends up being where I channel some of that anger. I'm fundamentally an engineer, so I tend to channel my anger into, okay, what do I do to fix it? How do I fix things? And that's where I go with it. And so solarpunk really is that. It's like the fixing, like, it's the DIY. We're going to fix it. We're going to repair, and we're going to build better, and that kind of thing. And so I super nerd out with that. But I definitely have characters that I've written that are like, you know, so I have a place to put that.
Yeah, it's interesting because personally, my like with the horror, a lot of horror is, you know, so if they don't come from anger, but I can definitely see that in yours, Maurice, especially way back with Orgy of Souls and that kind of
thing. Oh, that goes way back.
Yeah. Jason sent me a copy of that. Remember when we like were in Apex together? So after that, Jason's like, "Here, you got to read some more of his stuff," and he sent me a copy of that, and I still got it.
That's
a good stuff.
Yeah, that reminds me of when I wrote another novella called "Devil's Marionette," and I think that was the one I wrote just before Orgy of Souls. And a reader sent me an email and just says like, "Man, this book was so angry. I thought you were mad at me." And I'm like, "Oh, okay." Got it.
Amazing.
Oh, that's good. That's funny. Yeah. But it's like, it's interesting too, because like, I'm wondering like, cause you come from anger. And I'm just, it has me thinking now how many other horror writers also come from anger. I mean, Clive Barker, I think obviously does, but it just has me thinking about that now from a different perspective, because that's not what I would, because like, Susan, when you're talking about anxiety being the solar punk, that for me, horror is the anxiety, you know, that's with my own writing. So I just find that interesting, the different like avenues that I explored there.
Well, a couple weeks ago, I just had my most recent writer's conference, MoCon, and one of the discussions we had was between me, Dr. Chesha Burke, and Rath James White. And it was a sort of like a career retrospective, because when we all entered the genre at about the same time, and just sort of like talking about how, you know, what our careers looked like and you know, how things have changed, how things haven't changed, you know, that sort of thing. But it was interesting that a recurring thing that kept popping up was, you know, because we're Black horror writers. And so that whole idea of like, well, what is the source of horror for us? You know, so we keep coming back to this whole idea, like for some people, for horror, a lot of times it's, you know, this whole transgression of the mundane being the source of horror and anxiety and terror and that sort of thing. Then we're like, well, that's interesting, but it's actually the mundane that terrifies us, because what's mundane for you is oppressive systems for us.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so a lot of our horror ends up analyzing that, like what is our monsters? What are the monsters that we face to the point where it's like, oh man, the serial killer in the closet. Oh no, we're good. Yeah, that's fine. That's like the least of our worries at this point. You know, that sort of thing. I had a story come out, was it not last year? The year, I think it was like late in 2023. In Jordan Peele's Out There Screaming anthology.
Oh yeah, I read that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And the story I wrote was called the Norwood Trouble. And here's the thing about that story is that story is rooted in history, but it's the absolute real history of an area of town. I live in Indianapolis, and it's about a very real area of Indianapolis that basically went as it was a self-sufficient Black community that was undisturbed for about 100 years within our town that almost no one knew about. And when I didn't even do any of the research for it, because a friend of mine just was randomly talking to me, and she was just like, "Oh yeah, you know, there's this area of town. It's called Norwood, and like it's a self-sufficient Black community, and the pastors there would pastor their churches by day, and then by night cast Orisha spells of protection over the city." And I'm like, "Whoa, wait, hang on, what?
What?"
That's a great short story, actually.
Right? I said that story just wrote itself. I'm in. But the whole idea is like there's an area of town that is literally surrounded by sundown towns. And for those who don't know, sundown towns are towns that's like, it's all right if you're Black in that town by day, but when the sun goes down, you're Black behind, better be out of our city. And so you have this self-sufficient Black community literally surrounded on all sides by sundown towns.
Wow.
And the exploration of that, and like I said, this is all within the town was founded just after the Civil War. So we're talking like during the Reconstruction era is when the town gets founded, and it only gets dismantled right around the Civil Rights era. And so in that one story, I have the roots of like all the things, right? You have this entrenched history. You have these systems of oppression. You have this very real being surrounded by terror organizations trying to lynch and or dismantle you one way or the other. So, you know, you start asking, you know, where's the horror? Where's the horror? And then the horror is, yeah, while that, what, you know, we want to relegate that to the past, every last bit of that story is also our present. So, mm-hmm. So where's the horror? Where's my anger? And oddly enough, that story just comes pouring out of me.
Yeah, I've actually, I read that short story with my horror book club and right down the street from here. And we actually talked about that one probably more than any other of the short stories in there.
Oh, okay.
Ah.
Yeah, it was a really good one.
Thank you.
I think it's notable too that a lot of horror writers right now are, a lot of more popular horror writers right now are minorities of some sort. I mean, you've got, you know, Maurice, you've got Gabino Iglesias, you've got Tanana Reeve Dew, Nuzo Ono, John Campbell, I think that's his name, right? I saw him on a panel a few years ago. He was really good. And lots of trans folks are, you know, really big in horror right now. And then if you flip over to solar punk, I can't think of a ton of minorities in solar punk, but there are a lot of trans folks in solar punk.
Well, I don't know. Sure. I mean, it depends, because I think a lot of the if you go to Afrofuturism, which is, I think, a branch of solar punk, that's like a completely different thing. But it's also like mostly like, you know, goes against what you're saying. I'm just thinking, because I think I sent you an article about that too. Like I noticed there's actually quite a few people of color and stuff like that writing in solar punk, I thought, anyway.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You did send me that. Yeah.
I mean, that's just my personal experience.
Solar punk originated in Brazil. So I mean, like in terms of
Fabio Fernandez.
Yeah, the very first, you know, technically solar punk anthology came out of there. I think it's actually happening everywhere for sure, but it's also much smaller genre than horror is. So, you know, I think you're just going to see more people in general in horror, and you know, get more of that range. Solar punk. Part of the reason why I started my podcast, Bright Green Futures, is just like, where are the solar punk stories? How can we find them? Because once somebody finds it, they're like, hey, I want more of this. And it's just really small. So I'm trying to help people find those stories.
Yeah. I don't know if my Astra Black trilogy counts as solar punk, but it's definitely rooted in, well, obviously it's rooted in Afrofuturism, but at the base level, you know, and then actually stems from a lot of my community organizing work, which is, all right, hey, you know what? What if we win?
Yeah.
Have we ever stopped to ask that question? What if we win? What would the world, or what could the world look like if we could create systems on our terms?
Well, I will definitely have to go check that out then, because I would like to see and know, you know, what's going on.
Well, and the great part is in terms of practicality, all of a sudden I'm basically engaging in community dreaming alongside my neighbors, right? So I embark on this series. I think I do about a year and a half of just conversations with my neighbors. What could it look like? So if we could redo, for example, the education system, what could it look like? If we could talk about what would be the cultural priorities of society, what could that look like? You know, in terms of politics, how would we govern ourselves in a different way if we were free from the shadows of oppression? What could we come up with? It's one long exercise in community dreaming, as far as I was concerned.
I like that term, community dreaming. I think I'm going to maybe use that in about a week. I'm going to be teaching a class on.
Go for it.
Thank you. I'm teaching at Solarpunk Futures conference here in Pittsburgh, happening at the end of the month.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be teaching a class to kids, like high school students, junior high, but also adults, about how you can use Solarpunk to do that dreaming of the future, mm-hmm. you know, as a community. What is the future? You know, so I'm using tools of our imaginative tools that we as writers use all the time, but generally people don't necessarily know how to use. And so I'm giving them permission, but also some tools and guiding them in let's think about this. What would you, what makes you angry? What brings you joy? And, you know, what's your favorite trope? And let's make a story about that and then bring it back home and root it here today in how can you start heading towards that future that you're imagining?
Exactly.
And it's so important for it's like we've kind of turned off our brains collectively in imagining possibilities for the future. Mm-hmm. Or we've slotted them into one of three stories, that we're allowed to have, either it's Star Trek or Star Wars or I don't know, the dystopia, and that's it, and so we just we have real problems that need real solutions, and I'm glad to hear that idea of community dreaming is, I feel like that's popping up everywhere. There's a robustness to the solution of dreaming of a better future if people keep coming up with it in all these different circumstances.
Oddly enough, that's the title of the workshop, the community workshop I now do because of all of this, Dreaming of a Better Future. And it's basically a world building workshop. I mean, it's second nature to us. But and I think you used the exact terms, giving people permission to dream is such a huge, huge thing. And to talk to different community groups, and I'm like, no, as writers, we create with a blank page, which means anything is possible. And so, when I talk about the Astro Black trilogy, for example, I got starships powered by jazz music. Why?
That's awesome.
Because I can't. Right. It's possible.
You can. That's right.
Right. So, and usually once they hear something like that, then, especially when I'm working with kids, the gloves come off and they're like, oh, wait a second, we can do anything we want. And then you just see, and it's interesting when I've run it with kids versus adults, how the kids have no problem diving in and using their imagination. But it's like the older people get, the more they've gotten away from this idea of having that permission to dream, like somehow it's been squashed out of them. And so I just find it fascinating having to go through and no, in this space, we have permission to dream. So let's go for it.
That's so true. And it's so funny, too, because whenever I talk to people like librarians or booksellers about Solarpunk, they're like, well, here's our young adult section. And I'm like, you don't understand. Okay, the people who need this are the adults. Those are the people that are in crisis here. I mean, kids, sure. Kids are having crisis. Absolutely. Mental health issues because, I don't know, we live in the horrors. But, this is not just for children. We all need to be able to do this work to be able to move forward or even just cope. So,
Susan, I was wondering what you thought about this. And in fact, I think something similar to this got alluded into an article that one of y'all sent me, where it talked about, progressives and systems and stuff like that. To become radical. Hang on. Where's this quote?
Wait, are you talking about reading weird fiction in the age of fascism? Yes.
Yeah.
I want to talk about that.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So there's a line this that says, and it's one of the two axioms in it, but the first one really caught my attention because it's to become radical politically is to become aware that the dominant ideology shaping the way we view the world is wrong and needs revolutionary change from the root.
Yes.
And so one of the things I always keep in mind, actually, when I was doing that, when I was doing the world building with, you know, community dreaming, or when I'm running the seminars, one of the things I keep coming back to is like, no, the systems we're under are past the point of like revision or, you know, or anything like that. No, they're at the point of we need radical reimagining.
Right. They're actively breaking down as we speak.
Absolutely.
So, you know, like there will be no tweaking from, I mean, tweaking is if that's all you got, then okay, yes, but like, no, because we have, I really want to hear your reaction, Maurice, to that article, because I found it revolutionary. It gave me a lens that I didn't have before. I agreed with like very much, and I hope Alan will give the link in the notes or something so people can go read it, because it's a very, a little bit dense sort of intellectual analysis kind of piece, but it talks about weird fiction and horror as these reactions to the times that we're in. It's kind of like what we're talking about with horror and solarpunk. Okay. But particularly for me, it was fascinating that weird fiction is sort of like this unsettled and unsettling and open-ended feeling or vibe in stories, and how that's a reflection of like just this bone deep sense we have that something is wrong with the world and it's not getting better. And so, you know, I've actually personally been writing a couple of stories. I'm writing a story right now, short stories that were totally weird, quote unquote, for me, because they were kind of solar punk, but they also had this deeply bone, it's unsettling sense to them. I'm like, what is this thing? And I kind of come around to seeing it as being weird solar punk. So there's like, there's kind of a hybrid thing going on there for me. Now I'm still writing very, what I consider, you know, like mainstream solar punk, where we're doing solutions and it's the future and it's that community dreaming thing. But also when I just need to process my emotions, I end up going towards that weird solar punk area because I still want my values. Like I still want us to be in community. I still want, you know, collectivism and radical compassion. But also the world is really weird. And so what do we do with that? And my answer, instead of going like into dystopia, is to say, no, we're going to double down on being human and be really superhuman, and not superhuman like superheroes, but like extremely human in that weird world that we're in. So Maurice, what I want to like hear your thoughts about is how that aligns with some of like the horror that you've been writing, and or maybe the Afrofuturism. Like, are there hints of weird in there, or what do you think about all that?
Well, that last line of yours threw me off, because that whole idea of being very human centric actually becomes the baseline infrastructure for the world that when we end up doing our community world building, everyone starts with what does a human centered approach? What do systems that support our basic humanity, what does it look like if we just start there?
Right.
And build our systems, you know, in terms of how do we best support one another? And then what could that world look like? So I'm like, so we got that. And so put a pin in that. But then on the other side, it's, I'm thinking through, well, I mean, so as I was reading the article, my first reaction was, oh, hey, y'all, welcome to the revolution. Because in a lot of, I'm like, whoa, we've been here. I'm glad other folks have discovered that these are the times we now find ourselves in. So to your point about, for example, dystopias, right? You know, I think about how dystopias are what are they? They are baseline just critiques of the present. Mm-hmm. So we start that with the whole idea of dystopias. And so then I start thinking about, a book like Parable of the Sower, for example. Mm-hmm. And so you have this by Octavia E. Butler, one of the seminal Afrofuturist works. But there are key principles even in the midst of this dystopia. This, mind you, and I look at it as a this sounds weird, a hopeful dystopia. In that there are in the midst of all these systems collapsing, what are the key principles? What are the key characteristics that allow for the possibility of our survival and later thriving? And it boils down to you have the lead character who demonstrates great agency. And another skill that she has is this whole ability that she's adaptable, which is a key characteristic in that when you're surrounded by chaos, being adaptable is a key mm-hmm. characteristic. And then the third principle that she operates through is I can't do this on my own. So what does it look like to build community as I go? And even in the midst of dystopia, that you have those key principles, and then those key principles actually become undergird a lot of anything that I do in the Afrofuturist lens, or even if we classify it as solar punk, those would be the key principles I think that would undergird a lot of my work under all circumstances.
Right, and I think that's such a great point. How like dystopia isn't just the world is breaking down; it's like what do we do with that? And I think there's, you know, that's a lot of what that article was talking about, that weird fiction is speaking to, like, what do you do with this unsettled feeling? How do you keep going? What do you do with that? And, you know, some of it is we're just going to, like, raw emotional power. We're just going to power through it, right? Mm-hmm. But I think when you start to get into things like Parable of the Sower has much more, like, this is how humanity is, and let's, you know, this is how it should be, right? These mm-hmm. are the problems we're facing. This is how are we going to, like, tackle that? And that's what solar punk is. It sounds like you're like, already, you know, and this is how I get back to, like, solar punk is a tiny genre by name, but I feel like in vibes, it's, like, everywhere.
Well, it's funny you say that, because I always felt that about it. Whenever I end up talking about Afrofuturism, I feel the exact same way, because, like, people just discovered Afrofuturism when the Black Panther movie came out. So then all of a sudden, right. Afrofuturism pops into the pop culture or consciousness. But as a term, it came up in 1993 with I've just forgot his name, Mark. I blanked out on his name, but he was lamenting the lack of Black folks writing in these speculative genres, and so he named checks like Octavia Butler and Samuel Delaney and Stephen Barnes and Charles Saunders as, you know, these are the only ones working in this field in this area, and so people are like, oh well, Afrofuturism dates back to 1993, and I was like, well, no. This is the work we've always done as right. Black people. Mm-hmm. You know, you can go all the way back to Martin Delaney, frankly, in the 1800s, or W.E.B. Du Bois, and some of the short sci-fi stories mm-hmm. he was writing. It's like, no, Black people have always imagined themselves into the future. That's been that's been our literary basis, and frankly, a lot of our hope has been like, oh, no, we're going to imagine ourselves into the future, whether or not people are trying to erase it or not. We're going to begin with imagining ourselves into the future as our first act of resistance and revolution, as to paraphrase Tananarive Due.
You both have mentioned community quite a bit, and I know community is a big part of solar punk, and if you look bigger, hope punk, you know, since we're talking subgenres here. But have you all been seeing a lot of community starting in horror? Because I do not associate horror with the idea of community, you know, communities of characters accomplishing a goal. Usually I think of horror as like, oh my God, I'm in a closet and there's a psychopath outside and they're going to murder me, mm-hmm. or I'm running away from a monster and trying to survive, something like that.
Well, I mean, there's folk horror, I think, actually emphasizes community quite a lot. Mm-hmm. In the negative aspect, yes, but sometimes in the positive too. because you've got like the Wicker Man, things like that. I mean, if you ask a lot of pagans, the Wicker Man is a hopeful story, and that they think that the people on the island are the good guys, that kind of thing. And there's like a lot of other stories, like, you know, short stories and novels that have been coming out like in the last few years that are considered folk horror that actually delve into like both the horrors of community, which can be like seen as like the horrors of like the structure of oppression in our current society, as well as like the benefit of a community working together against a horror. Like, I'm trying to think of some examples that aren't Stephen King.
Unfortunately, yes, Stephen King was right where I went. Because the first thing that popped to mind was The Stand, literally.
Yeah, The Stand, mm-hmm. It as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, well, that's true.
Because it's the kids all working together, yeah. Yeah, because that's, yeah, even in The Stand, he, like, has that famous line. Everyone's like, you know, that they had come together to stand against, you know, evil, everything else, even if they would lose, the standing is the important part.
That's a good quote.
I think one of the things that motivates solar punk stories is that we feel like there's a hole where we're not, where community has been written out of the story, as in The Great Derangement, Amitav Ghosh says, we've stopped imagining, we only imagine the hero and the hero's journey, and like this lot of, you know, individualism, rugged individualism, where's the community? We've written the community out. And so we have a hard time imagining a future where that's written back in. And so that's kind of a lot of the work that solar punk does. It kind of sounds, what I'm hearing you say about horror is that it's imagining both sides of that, not just like community is the solution, but also community has been and is the problem, right? And so, like, how do we grapple with that in our stories? And really, a lot of our stories are about community. It's just that it's the default status quo that's sort of unspoken. Like, well, of course, it's going to be like this. That's just kind of given. And now I'm going to go on my adventure. And, like, you know, we need to figure out ways to tell different stories than that. That's what solar punk is saying about community.
I just remembered the other author I was thinking of, Stephen Graham Jones, his third book in the Indian Lake trilogy, The Angel of Indian Lake. That one is all about like a community of final girls, basically. It's turning the idea, because he talks a lot about slashers, that kind of thing. That whole series is about slashers and the whole idea of final girls. And in the last book, yeah, he kind of turns the idea on its head, and that community fighting against like these oppressive evils is what saves us, and not just a single final girl. It's a really good book, actually. If anyone, like, you have to read the other books in this series to kind of get the emotional power at the end of it, especially the afterword. But like, yeah, you have like that, it's worth
I'm stuck thinking. Well, not stuck thinking, but you got me thinking about how I guess one of the themes that I realize I've been writing about a lot lately is the whole idea of communities of resistance. So it's not even a particular hero per se, but it's actually a community itself is the heroic figure. So even with that Jordan Peele story, is the community of Norwood is the hero in that story. And I'm just thinking through some of my other stories that are actually coming out here pretty soon. It's like, you know, you have heroes in different communities in different contexts, but it's all about communities banding together to resist the great evil. So, and the evil being representing, you know, whatever oppressive system we're under, but, you know, it's always that whole idea of like, what does, and it's something I've been thinking a lot about lately in a lot of my work is like, how do we use the idea of community, the idea of culture to build resistance and resilience?
Oh yeah. And resilience is so at the top of mind for me right now, as I break down under the fall of the American Empire. but the community, I mean, there always have been like African American communities have those communities have like, because they needed that to survive, right? The resilience came from having that community. Same thing with like queer communities where people find each other because they have to in order to survive. And, you know, what I think a lot of the weird fiction now is coming out of is like the mainstream community that has always been like the source of a lot of the oppression is also having its breakdown. And people are realizing that it's all the community that maybe we had at some level is being broken. And whether that's the internet, whether it's capitalism, whether it's, you know, the rise of fascism, all of those things are contributing. But, you know, these stories, these the smaller communities that we have that model resistance and resilience are a huge source of inspiration, I think, but also just like information about how does this work? What are the problems? How do you navigate those communities and how do you build them? And so we've got this climate crisis that is coming through and just wiping whole towns off the map and is burning down. You know, I had a kid who had to evacuate from the LA wildfires. And, you know, it's going to touch everybody personally eventually, if it hasn't already. And what I see time and again that comes out of that is instant communities of resilience are built because we have to, because you're in a crisis. And don't let any disaster go unused, or how is that saying go, where there's opportunity there to build something out of crisis. And, you know, looking to people who already know how to build this, great. But also there's going to be like pockets of this happening everywhere. And imaginatively, what Solarpunk does, at least what I'm trying to do with some of my stuff, is to give us a little bit of template. So we can say, hey, you know, maybe something like this, if you find yourself in a pickle, would be a good approach rather than just like imagining that everybody's going Mad Max.
As much as I love Mad Max, I never found it to be super realistic. You know,
I'll tell you, like, just a small, you know, example of how even if we don't think those are realistic stories, they still inform our idea of what's possible. I recently had like this 5-day power outage in Pittsburgh, right? Y'all remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We were one of the last ones to get power back because we're like out on the outskirts. And so my whole neighborhood was without power for this whole time. But I have solar and I have a backup battery. And so I put out a chair that said, you know, had a power strip plugged into my outlet. And I said, you know, it says free power because like all you can do is like charge your cell phone with it, right? Or your laptop. But I send out because I have an HOA, you know, God help me. So I put out a message on the HOA email list and said, hey, you know, look, folks, I've got extra power. If you need it, come get it. And people were just like, they acted like I had, you know, offered up my firstborn to the community. Like, it was the smallest act possible that I could have done to, like, share in the community. And people were just gobsmacked.
Right.
And but they came. And they used it. And, they, you know, we built a little bit of community there where we got to know each other. People that, you know, are not, would never cross paths normally. And so I see stuff like that and I'm like, my gosh, we have so far to go imaginatively. Mm-hmm. If that is mm-hmm. a shocker to you, right? Like, right. Come on. Mm-hmm. So it's important work.
I do feel like we live in very selfish times.
I think it's more just isolated. Like, we kind of tell each other we're selfish, but like, really, are we really felt like, yes, okay, there are some people who are genuinely selfish. We all know them. But, you know, most of us know, most of us are told that we're supposed to be, but we don't like it. And like, we're not selfish with your friends and your family, people you care about, right? So we have those alternate stories already around us all the time, but we have the dominant stories that tell us who we're supposed to be. And those are just so, so wrong.
Yeah. And I was literally just thinking about that, the whole idea of like, what stories have we chosen to buy into? And so, so you have the majority culture who spins this narrative of, you know, our chief aim is to be rugged individuals. And I'm like, well, yeah. As the majority culture, you can afford to be rugged individuals. The rest of us, yeah, kind of need community in order if we're going to make any sort of stand whatsoever. But even the rugged individuals, that story is a myth. The whole idea of being a rugged individual is a myth. The self-made man is a myth. And it's almost like the stories are in place to keep us from being and striving towards this whole idea of community, because these self-made people, all these rugged individuals would not be where they are because they did not spring up out of nothing. They sprung up out of community, supported by community along the way. They just take credit for it on us, but apparently for being on their own. But the whole idea is they none of us get anywhere without each other, period.
So true.
Yep. There's just some people step on other people to get up there.
Yeah, there is that.
There is that, but that is also ultimately destructive. I mean, as we know, but like even to the people who are stepping on other people, like, is that person truly happy and living a fulfilled life? I feel no. you know, so we're robbed, I think, of a lot. And I think you're exactly right, Maurice. It's a story that's told to keep us from forming community. So forming community, and I've said this many times, especially since the election, like one of the most radical things any of us can do right now is form communities of care outside of capitalism. However that looks for you and your community, and like make it happen. And that is the beginning of change. And I really believe that. And I think it resonates with people because they want it. They don't always know how to do it. Which actually, oh, Maurice, this brings me to libraries.
Yes.
So I have been going around with my passport to the Carnegie Pittsburgh library system and getting my passport stamped at all the different libraries and all the different communities, which is like, I'm just giddy like a child with this. I love it so much. And so I'm like posting because Fridays are my library day. So like every Friday I'm posting about these things and like excited and people are excited for it. And the librarians are like, you're a strange bird that has come into our library. Right. Yes, let me give you a stamp. But I really feel like the library is such an important model of how we build a community resource using community funds, and everybody gets to come. Everybody is welcome. The one I was in on Friday had a seed library that somebody had set up, and they're just so, you know, they have tool libraries and game libraries, and like there's just so much going on. So, like, you're a live librarian. So, please tell us what are you seeing in the library space? Obviously, libraries are under attack and like right. Like, we need to defend them. But like, what are you seeing that is being embodied of like third spaces, solar punk kind of stuff in your library spaces?
Okay. Yeah. So I'll back up a little bit. And so we'll talk about, you know, the greater power of stories, what's the power of Afrofuturism? What's the power of solar punk? What's the power of hope punk? You are creating possibilities. We cannot create what we cannot imagine. Mm-hmm. Right. And so the stories allow us to, you know, to visualize, to put these vague ideas into something concrete that we can now picture. Right. And so I say all that to go. So I have a story in Apex magazine called the Legacy of Alexandria. And it's a near future story, and it's all about, this library in the hood, basically. So the city's under martial law. And the idea of this library has been reduced to a myth that this young boy and his dog are off to try and find in the city. So they have to, you know, navigate all these, you know, checkpoints in the city and everything as they're trying to find this mythological library in the hood. And then he finds it, and it's run by this librarian. And basically the library serves as the hub of community resistance.
Nice.
Right. And part of her credo is, look here, I'm here to train troops, and I need my troops well trained. And how do I train my troops? I get them reading.
Oh my gosh, I love it. I must read this story immediately.
Okay. But I bring that up because now there were librarians in my life who had inspired that story, right? Well, then my school comes to me and is just like, hey, did you know the school used to be the site of the Paul Laurence Dunbar Library? And I'm like, I had no idea what we were, and I have no idea what that was. And then so I start doing my thing. So it's like, oh, the Paul Laurence Dunbar Library was a library within the public school in Indianapolis. And at the time, public school libraries were actually libraries for the whole public. I mean, school library, the school libraries were libraries for the public. And so the Paul Lawrence Dunbar Library was like the first library to serve the Black community in Indianapolis. And so then I get put in charge of, I was asked to lead the project to restore this library. So I put in some stipulations about, all right, so if you want me to do this, cause, I work for a private Christian middle school. And I said, if I'm going to do this, I had some stipulations, and one is, and basically two stipulations. One, I'm not going to put in a bunch of effort just to make this place a better place. If I'm going to restore it, I want it to restore it to the library's original function, which is to be a blessing to the community, to serve the community. And part of that means I want to be able to grow three special collections. And so I have like a Harlem Renaissance collection, a Black Arts Movement collection, and an Afrofuturism collection.
Oh, nice.
Right. And I run a residency program out of it so that students and community can come and be involved with the library. Because you're right, I live in Indiana, and libraries are under attack. Activities of librarians are literally being criminalized. The lawmakers of Indiana exempted private schools, particularly private Christian schools, from the reach of law because of a failure of imagination. They not at any point did they imagine one of their private Christian schools would be the blackest spot as far as
I love it right. So much.
so that's been happening. And I haven't had a lot of pushback. Well, knock on wood, and I should say yet, because this is literally my first year of full-time operation. Because people are well aware of the history and legacy of the space that we're in. So we have that. Another thing we have is that I tell people all the time, hey, my role as librarian, because libraries were special places for me growing up too. They were safe havens for me. And my chief compliment I get from students is like, oh no, the library is a safe place for us. And I'm like, then I've done my job. When all said and done, I've done my job. But then I also remind people my job is also to protect marginalized voices. So you will see voices on these shelves because it is our job to safeguard them and create space for them and then protect them. And that's our model in the library. And I'm like, and hey kids, that's our model as we move through the world, period. So it's just one of these things. Now I even have students returning back to the library because even though they've actually graduated from the middle school, they come back like, hey, we've heard about the library. Can we come? Can we just sit in the spaces? I've had parents come and just sit in the space and have their children sit in the space because they tell their kids, hey, come sit and absorb the history of this space. Because one third of the room is still the original woodwork from the original Paul Lawrence Dunbar Library. So like, come sit on this bench and absorb the history of this space. Alumni from the school will return just to go, oh, wow. This, the legacy is continuing. Our stories are not being forgotten. And I'm like, all that goes into, you know, this part of my job as a librarian is like, I'm here to safeguard stories. I'm here to preserve stories. I'm here to transmit stories to the next generation and create spaces for them to absorb those stories. So that's where I stand.
What a magical space you are creating. I am so deeply impressed with that and excited for that to be in existence, you know, and when I go around every Friday to all these different neighborhoods, like, which I'm new to Pittsburgh, so it's helping me to explore different neighborhoods. One of the, mm-hmm. the best pleasures is, you know, I'm there Friday afternoons, and what comes in Friday afternoons? The kids, right? They're all like, flood into the library, and they're all like loud, and the librarians are like, be quiet, you know. And
oh, my goodness,
it's so great because
the kids are next level because now that they have their own library, like they know library because we're part of the shared system in Indianapolis, so that means that they can order books from any library and they'll be delivered to our school. And then I'll sort them and check them out for the students, and they know that happens on Wednesday.
Okay.
And I'm like, look, the books don't come. And every week, the books don't come till 9:30. It'll take me a couple hours to sort them, kids, just so you know. But let me tell you, starting at 11:30, because they will spot me my 2 hours. But at 11:30, they're at the door. Mr. Brothers, where's my books? Mr. Broadus, where's my books? You said my books would be ready, but now, Mr. Broadus. And
I love that they respect your 2 hours. You
right,
know?
Yeah, exactly 2 hours. And there was one day I was absent on I was actually absent on Wednesday, but I did go ahead and come back in like late Wednesday evening and get the book sorted. But then when I walked into the building on Thursday morning at 8 o'clock in the morning, I had two students waiting for me at the door going, Mr. Broadus, where's my books? And they escorted me to the library doors to make sure that I made it there safely to get them their books.
So, Maurice, you need to, like, write a story now where there's, like, a librarian rock star who's just, like, the most popular guy in the entire neighborhood. You know? Right, you like, go. It's so great. I love it.
I love it. Well, we actually only have, like, 3 more minutes left.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Oh, geez. Well, this has been delightful. I'm so pleased that I was able to come in and be in conversation with all of you, but mostly Maurice, because Maurice and I are just going. But it's been wonderful.
Good. Yeah, I really appreciate this.
Yeah, that's the fun part about a panel. You guys panelists. You know, talk, make our job easier.
Yeah, honestly, my favorite podcasts are ones where I don't have to talk too much.
Yeah, that's when you know you're doing a good job. So you got the right people and you know they're talking, they're keeping it going. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I guess I want to close this up and just say thank you everyone for coming together and making this happen. I honestly feel like we could have gone for another hour easily, you know. But you all had some super awesome, insightful things to say.
Thank you.
I appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you.